welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. According to this week's guest, New York Times columnist Paul Sullivan, wealth is not just a number in the bank account. According to his popular new book, The Thin Green Line, wealth is a form of behavior, an adjustment in your decision-making, and a redefinition of money. No matter what your income level is, Paul will tell you how can we avoid the pitfalls around saving, spending, investing, taxes, and charity. And most importantly, he will give us the keys to thinking differently about wealth so we can lead to more secure and a less stressful life. While some rich people never find true wealth, others, maybe even you, can become much wealthier. It's time for the money secrets of the super wealthy. Paul, welcome. Super wealthy. Paul, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me on.
And I appreciate your book. Now, it's Secrets of the Super Wealthy. Well, obviously, there are no more secrets because you told them all, but there goes the secret part. So let me ask this question. What does it mean, the difference between being wealthy and rich?
Sure. That's one of the central tenets of the book. And, you know, that subtitle, The Secrets of the Super Wealthy, people have a lot of fun with it. But, you know, the whole concept of the book, the title being The Thin Green Line, is how do we get on the right side of the thin green line? And in my research, it's you want to be on the wealthy side. And wealthy is another way of saying secure. But if you think of that line as the S&P 500 over the past 50 years, starts low, goes high, little dips and doodles along the way. But if you're on top of that, you're standing. It's like you're strolling up a mountain. It's not that strenuous. But if you notice, it starts low, so it's not saying what your income is. It's saying you've gotten to a certain point where you're making choice. You could be a school teacher, you could be a hedge fund manager, but you're able to make choices that make you secure. Everyone else on the other side of that line, that's the people who are rich. They may be poor, they may not even be, you know, able to be part of this conversation, but those who are rich and have choices, they're not making them. To them, rich is just a number. It's a number on a brokerage statement. It could be a beautiful home, could be a bunch of cars, but they're not secure. As we saw in 2007, 2008, there are plenty of people who seemed rich. And then within a couple of years, they had very little, if not nothing. And those are people who lack the security of the wealthy. And that's, you know, really the people that I'm driving at in this book.
And there are two different things that come to my mind. One is I do executive life coaching and neuroplasticity, which is clinical hypnosis, for the last 35 years. And I have one client. She's worth about $8 billion in real estate. And she came in one day and she said, I'm going to jump out of your window because I lost $1.5 billion. And I said to her, I won't mention, of course, her name, you have $6.5 billion. You're 59 years old. You know what? I'll open the window. Okay. You know, now she was obviously not wealthy. She was rich because if I'm hearing you correctly, that wealth has two elements to it. One is a control over your own financial destiny, a sense of participation, decision-making, and also a mental mindset of safety. Because if you don't feel safe, it doesn't matter how much money you have, you're still poor, right?
Sure. And I get to this toward the end of the book, in which I fly out to Manhattan, Kansas, that is, where Kansas State University is. And they're doing all kinds of research in their financial therapy program about sort of, you know, how we truly feel about money, our sort of ingrained thoughts about money. Just as, you know, normal psychotherapy works people through issues they have, they focus only on money. And they found that people have four money scripts: avoidance, status, worship, and vigilance. And listen to the story about this $8 billion woman who has to make due on $6.5 billion. This is the first thing that came to mind, because if you have money avoidance, well, you've had some sort of bad experience with money, you don't want it. Or you think the only people who have money who've gotten money by doing something bad, the rich people are evil. Well, if you have money worship, you just think, if I have more money, everything in my life will be fine. Money status, well, that's where your self-worth and your net worth are equal. And I'm wondering if that maybe is this woman here. And of course, then there's money vigilance. And money vigilance on the face doesn't sound bad, but those are people who are hoarders. They're stingy. You know, they're never going to run out of money, but they're not going to fully enjoy the money they have. I mean, their kids and grandkids are going to benefit, but they're not going to. And I hear this about this woman, and I think, you know, a lot of times when financial advisors get brought in, they put together a plan, they try to help people, you know, allocate their assets. all of which is very rational, but it doesn't get to the story you just told me, which is how do you get to that more ingrained behavioral part of people? You know, why was that, you know, a billion five, you know, so tough for her? I mean, nobody wants to lose any money, but, you know,
the answer to that, it's really how you were raised. I should have said she was the daughter of Holocaust survivors, and that kind of gives a little bit of a background. And what I find, you know, there's a verse in Scripture that says money answers all things. Now, what does that mean? It means that it gives choices, sure. That money creates the ability to have a choice. Will I have a steak or a hamburger? You know, but they could taste the same.
Well, we need fish and vegetables. We got to be healthier, huh? Yeah,
exactly.
We got to say no to both of them.
Exactly. You know, and for some, because I'm a hardcore believer in capitalism because I actually believe that capitalism allows people to create things that gives other people more choices. However, I am not against capitalism that creates the super poor, where as part of it would be difficult for me to be the head of a corporation where I am underpaying people and causing them to have miserable lives at the cost of me having a great life. That would be difficult for me. Which is why I do what I do, so I don't have to make those choices. So, Paul, are you rich or wealthy?
I'm wealthy.
You're wealthy?
Yeah.
Okay, so you don't have money fears. Do you have money concerns?
Well, I mean, in the course of writing this book, I mean, I realize that I do have this sort of money vigilance script. But just like anybody who goes through any sort of, you know, type of therapy, you know, being aware of it is something that helps me make better decisions. But, you know, I'm glad, you know, you used the word choice when you were talking, because so much of this book is about the choices and decisions that people make and the behaviors that they have around wealth or around just money in general. And I think that's so essential because it allows us the hope, at least, that we can change our behaviors, that we can realize, okay, this is the right way to do things, this is the wrong way to do things. And, you know, at no point in my book do I get on the bandwagon of give up your Starbucks lattes. I think you should have your Starbucks lattes.
I think he owns the stock, guys. No, okay, no. Just so you let you know.
No, or if you know what you really want is a steak, you should go and have that steak. But you have to make those choices. If you're not, you know, somebody with $6.5 billion, you're making a lot more choices every day. It's like, okay, what is my ultimate goal? What do I want to do? Is it about buying a house? Is it about saving for my kids' college? Is it retiring at 60, 70? That involves a lot of choices. And, you know, that's the good news. The bad news is there's no prescription. I can't say, okay, do the following 17 things and I guarantee everything will turn out great when you're 70.
Right. I want to go through a couple of myths that I could tell the audience, and I want your feedback from it. One is that if I had enough money, I would definitely be happy. Money doesn't create happiness. The right attitude about life creates happiness. I treat some of the most wealthy and powerful people around, and they are miserable. Okay, so money doesn't necessarily also solve your emotional issues. It not only doesn't create happiness, it's not a prescription for solving your emotional issues, and that people who make money are not necessarily smarter than the average cab driver. That sometimes they're luckier and sometimes they have the right connections. So give me those two myths. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the money happiness myth, we talk about that a lot. I mean, look, if you're a miserable bastard and you're broke, chances are you're still going to be a miserable bastard when you're rich. You're just going to have a lot more choices, and hopefully you can take a nicer trip to become a little less miserable.
And better medication.
And better medication as well. But I will say that, you know, the sort of myth about intelligence and the connection to wealth. Many of the super wealthy people I interviewed, they all acknowledge that they worked hard. They don't say, I'm necessarily brighter than the next guy. They worked really, really hard. They worked long hours. They dedicated themselves almost myopically to one thing. But they all, to a T, acknowledge luck. Their idea was a good idea. They worked hard at their good idea. But a lot of other people had good ideas, worked hard at it, and didn't become as phenomenally wealthy as they did. So there is that component of right place, right time. At least, you know, at the end of it all, that's how they're acknowledging
it. Well, let me add to this. I think one of the smartest men that I coach, and he's one of my favorite people, he also has found the secret of wealth is to surround yourself with really bright people and to be humble enough to know what you don't know and to make sure that those around you are brilliant in what they do and you get good guidance. So that's also a good thing to do. Now, question. The person who is trying to build wealth, who could they trust, Paul? Paul, you know, you're an expert. You've been around a lot of people who I imagine that you have more or less confidence in. But what advice would you give the audience that is going to be listening to you from around the world as to who can you trust in managing your money?
And you mean in terms of like finding an advisor or something?
Yeah. Or even, you know, doing a budget, financial advice, you know, who can you trust?
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult question. I mean, there's a time when, you know, most people who write about money, as I do, the knee-jerk reaction is to say you go to a registered investment advisor who has a fiduciary responsibility, which to most people is a whole bunch of gobbledygook because they have no idea what I just said. They have no idea what it means.
It's also saying if you're sick, go to a doctor. I
mean, well, no, because there's a difference. You know, you can go to a broker at one of the wirehouse firms, and they, you know, they're not subject to the fiduciary standard. They have something called suitability. Again, I'm further baffling listeners right now.
No, non-listeners actually are fairly intelligent. So,
right, but this is stuff that bores most people. And so, you know, what is the best thing you can hope to achieve in an advisor? Well, I say in the chapter on investing, I call the chapter, you know, looking at stock quotes can be hazardous to your wealth. And I think too often when people think about advice around their money, they think, okay, give me some tips. How am I going to invest this? What stock should I buy? What bond should I buy? Well, at the end of the day, if somebody comes to you, some advisor comes to you and says, you know what, I think you should buy the following seven stocks. These are guaranteed winners. Don't trust that person. He's lying. I mean, the most that you can hope for is to have a broadly diversified portfolio that's low cost, that, you know, has the expectation that it's going to rise as the market rises, because we don't know. We honestly don't know. You know, stock A could look fantastic today, and then you find out that the company, you know, the CEO has done something horrendous. You learn that tomorrow. What a good advisor can do is not help you, you know, pick the seven winners. A good advisor can help you think about money in a more holistic way. They can help you think about the things you can control. What can you control? You can't control where the stock market is going to end at the end of today. You can control how much money you save, how you save it. You can control how much money you spend. If you're inclined to give to charity, you can control how you give to charity. And by that, I don't mean, you know, being stingy or generous. I mean, you know, certain vehicles that'll maximize your tax benefit to give to charity.
And maybe you could control your wife and kids who spend all your money.
Well, that's spending and saving, too, yeah. But that's having those difficult conversations that, as you know, in your coaching life, people don't want to have. I mean, there are, you know, any advisor, any therapist, any coach could go to somebody and say, look, buddy, I've seen this a million times before. You need to do the following 10 things, and you'll be fine. And he'll just nod his head and say, oh, yeah. But it doesn't work that way. The person has to come to that realization himself or herself and say, okay, yeah, you know, he said some good stuff today. Yeah, maybe I do. Maybe I do need to do that. But it's having that difficult conversation with your spouse. It's having those open conversations with your children so they, you know, don't go on Zillow and say, hey, Dad, you know, our house is worth $5.5 million. You said we had to save money. I think $5.5 million is a lot. I mean, kids are going to find this stuff out. So it's the people who want to, you know, keep everything secret and keep it locked down who are going to have a lot of problems and could benefit from an advisor who could help them.
And people should know this, that there are people with $5.5 million houses that are cash poor, that don't have the same lifestyle as the person who's living in a $300,000 house and has the similar income but chooses not to say I'm wealthy and yet really has cash flow.
100%. I mean, that person in the $5.5 million house could be wildly over-leveraged. Anything
debt.
Goes wrong, that annual bonus is less than it was last year, that person's in a lot of trouble. That $300,000 person, that house, that person's wealthy. Why? Because they have choice. You know, life is not going to make choices for them. They're going to be able to make choices in life. And I'm glad you brought that up because that's a key distinction.
You know, doing neuroplasticity, and to make it quite simple, it's the difference between the frontal lobe, which is the rational brain, and the mammal brain on top, which is the brain you're born with that has all the emotions and all the neuroses and all the fear of the what-ifs. So having said that, that wealth is not only about what you create but how you perceive it, how would you tell parents they should train their children and each partner about money? Like, what should the dialogue be about? Should it be about putting together a budget?
Budgets are like diets. They fail. They okay. should have a plan.
Well, what's the difference between a budget and a plan?
What's your ultimate goal? A plan is aiming toward something.
Yeah, but ultimate goal, isn't that more philosophical, but a budget is more practical?
It's a 5-10 year plan. You know, we can't really, you would know this from your practice, you can't really imagine out more than 10 years. It becomes too overwhelming to people. This is why it's so difficult for people to save properly for retirement. When they're 25, they can't even imagine what they're going to be doing at 65 or 75. It sort of blows their mind. But some sort of plan in sort of, you know, incremental stage and sticking to that plan, that helps a lot more.
Okay, but how about this? And let me throw this out. If life is measured in actual memory, since no one really knows what's happening next, so the only thing you have are your memories of that which you create, why not use most of your money to create a lot of knowledge, a lot of wisdom, a lot of friendship, and a lot of experience? And then why do you care if you live to be 85 or 95? I don't want to live that long. It really does.
I'll come and ask you that question when you're 82.
Trust me. Trust me. Like, why? As long as I'm vital, as long as I could, you know, as long as I could contribute to the world around me and enjoy life, you know, I don't want to be taken care of. That wouldn't be something that I would enjoy.
Sure. And that's a choice. And that's great. But, I mean, there are kind of several parts to your question. It's a great question. But if you think about, you know, how are you going to talk to people about money? Well, talking is a good start, because I equate in the book that, you know, we're far more willing to talk openly about disease. Somebody gets cancer, you'll talk about it. We'll talk about sex. We'll talk about our sex lives. Talk about that openly. When it comes to money, people clam up.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can ask the person how many times have you gotten laid? They'll answer you. How much money in the bank? They won't.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And then they say, oh, yeah, now, I went to the doctor and he did this horrible exam. You're like, oh my God, please keep that to yourself.
So I'm going to tell you why I think people are afraid to talk about money, and you tell me why you think. I think they are because people judge themselves, their success, their worth, what their status is in this world by how much money they make, and therefore they're not going to talk about it because they're really insecure about what other people are going to think.
Yeah, that's where they're rich, and rich is always relative. Rich is always comparing yourself to somebody, you know, next to you. And, you know, I joke in the book, I call it the Naples effect. And I named that after Naples, Florida, a lovely seaside town where I spent a lot of time. And you show up in Naples and you may have been the biggest deal in your small town. And you sell your $500,000 house, which was a big deal.
Oh, it's a mansion.
It's a mansion in your small town because you owned grocery stores, you owned a car dealers, or whatever you owned. And you're very successful. And you take that and you move down as the former big man in town to Naples, Florida. And that $500,000 will maybe buy you a 2-bedroom condominium nowhere near the beach. And if you want to get to the beach, you're looking at a $40 million house, a $30 million house. And so many people who arrive in a place like Naples, and it could be Palm Beach, there are many, you know, retirement-type places like this. They've all come as the most successful person wherever they were. And now you have these, and we owned a condo in Naples for a while, and you have these horrendous battles among people who are trying to fight for primacy. You know, they're not there anymore. And this is the relative nature of richness. And it breeds a lot of insecurity. Whereas at the end of the day, what if people ask themselves, you know, what is enough? What do I want to do? You want to be vital. You want to create memories. You want to do that. That's fine. That's a plan. How do you accomplish that? It doesn't matter what I want to do. It doesn't matter what your neighbor wants to do. None of that matters. What matters is, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to take, you know, 3 vacations a year with my family. And, you know, once a month when I go out to dinner, I want to have a great bottle of wine or something like that. Fine. You know, it doesn't matter. It should not matter to you if the guy next to you takes 5 vacations a year and drinks better wine, because it's that sense of enough. And I think that's what a lot of people are lacking. It's like, well, what is enough? There's a void that they're trying to fill with money, and you're never going to be able to fill that void.
I also find, now this is my experience dealing with a lot of wealthy people, that a lot of wealthy people are less faithful in their relationships than those who have less money. And now the reason for that is sometimes it's simply time and opportunity. And if the middle class or the lower middle class had the time and opportunity, maybe they would do the same thing. But I do think that once you get used to a certain amount of wealth and richness, that you become less and less things stimulate you. And it's harder, it's come kind of like a drug. It's harder to get high because you've bought yourself whatever you wanted to. And now you're looking in different areas to get high, which is why a lot of CEOs that I treat for things that you would never expect a CEO to be, you know, have a problem with, certain drugs and so on and so forth. Do you find that the wealthy are harder to actually have a genuine down-to-earth conversation? And which type of wealthy people or rich people, what makes the difference between the sane and healthy personality and the neurotic and protective personality?
Yeah, and I think, you know, without knowing your clients, I would say, if these people are coming in, they may be, by my definition, rich. You know, could be worth billions of dollars, but they don't have that inner confidence, that security that a wealthy person would have. And the wealthy people I've talked to, I mean, there's a fellow in my book, John Huntsman Sr. He's an industrialist, created the clamshell package that the Big Mac is in. He's one of the first people in America to give away $1 billion. He's funding cancer research. You talk to him, he had all the time in the world for me. Hours and hours went by. Very secure guy. Accomplished what he wanted to accomplish. Doesn't, you know, have any visible neuroses. Just a lovely, lovely 70-something-year-old man to talk to. But, you know, others, you know, as we talked about earlier in this podcast, they're trying to fill some sort of void with money. Perhaps they have one of those, you know, those money scripts. There's another part to what you said, though, is that, you know, feeling satisfied, I mean, that takes a lot of self-awareness. In my book, I talk about the Bordeaux dilemma, and I say that, you know, my favorite wine, my favorite type of wine is a Chateau Margaux. And so anybody who knows wine knows that you're getting a bad Chateau Margaux at $500. A good one is, you know, in the thousands of dollars, and it goes up from there. My wife and I do not have this very often, but when we do, we really appreciate it. But
I would really appreciate it if you invite
also,
me out
you
when
can
you
come
do.
Next time. just sit quietly at the table.
Get him to sign the paper before, you know.
But
like I would know the difference between a $1,000 bottle of wine.
But there's things in your life where you would. There are things in your life where you would. And that's important to us. And I'd say that, you know, there are days when I wish I'd never had more than a $20 bottle of wine because I'd never know what I was missing. So if you're a car guy, the first time you ride in a Mercedes, man, this is pretty good. And then, you know, when you've just bought your 10th Mercedes, it's not such a big deal anymore because you're used to that. You know, go sit in a Chevy and see how that feels, and it'll make you appreciate your Mercedes again. But there are things like this in everybody's lives that they're not cognizant of until I think it becomes problematic. But as you go up, you know, a Mercedes is more comfortable than a Toyota. There's no way around it. You can say, oh, why do I want to spend $100,000 for a car when I could spend $20,000? That's a different decision. But you can't say that it's not a better product. And so once you get used to those better products, you know, some people are naturally always looking for the new thing.
Yeah, but
what
you,
is that better
you
product?
You just, in fact, in a sense, contradicted yourself. Because,
tell me.
Because if in fact, the Toyota or the Chevy gets the job done and you become incredibly comfortable and you don't know that you're not, that there's something more comfortable, and for your body it registers comfort, then going up to the Mercedes, I mean, you can't commit suicide jumping out of a basement, Paul. You can't. You have to be on a high floor, okay? So if you're living a life—
You could bang your head trying to get out of one of those small windows, and that would really hurt and be embarrassing in a different way.
You know, but so if you're living a little bit lower and you're comfortable, and the chances are if you have a certain amount of income and your business is worth a certain amount of money and it secures the number of years that you could live like that, then living larger might become more dangerous.
Well, but I'm glad you brought that up because it's perfect because it gets back to my point of choice. You may think a Toyota is perfectly fine. Ray Dalio, who runs the largest hedge fund in the world called Bridgewater, for years he supposedly drove a Toyota Corolla. This is a man worth billions and billions of dollars. That was his choice. I also know that he has an amazing yacht in Westport that he takes out, and that's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of million dollar yacht. He's made a choice. He's happy, you know, schlepping back and forth to work in his Toyota, but the choice he wants to make is he really enjoys, you know, being on his yacht, and that's his his luxury. And he's a wealthy guy by any definition, but he's made those choices and he has those behaviors that allow you to say, okay, the yacht matters, the car doesn't matter. For some people, you know, if you live in L.A. and you're driving all the time, you want a nice car. You're sitting in a car. If you live in New York, you know, you're just parking it at the train.
He's either wealthy or bipolar, one or the other. No, but so Warren Buffett was like that too. He drove, you know, an old car for a very long time, lived in the same house for a very long time.
But he also always says that his luxury is he bought NetJets and he flies everywhere privately. He has not been on a commercial airline in decades.
So everyone picks the things that make them feel good.
Exactly.
Okay. Do you find that as people get older and they get closer and closer to the dirt nap, do you find that their attitude about money...
Is that a scientific phrase? Is that a technical
phrase? It's a Dr. G phrase. You know, do you find that their attitude about money changes?
Sure, because then it's no longer about you anymore. It's about, you know, what has my... I mean, this, again, predicated on you're not worried about running out of money before you take that dirt nap. You know, you have enough money so you can make choices. Your attitude changes because you start thinking, okay, what has this meant? You know, what is this? Do I leave this to my children? Do I leave it to my grandchildren? Do I leave it to charity? And that's when, particularly people who are very wealthy and rich, who have a lot of money, that's when it becomes complicated because it's not so much what's my life worth at work going to become. It's much more, you know, what will this money do to my children and my grandchildren? Or, you know, will XYZ charity, will my $10 million even matter to them? I mean, is it a useless thing to give them $10 million because it's just a rounding error for them?
Could it ruin their life? Do you have married kids?
Yeah, two kids.
Okay, and how old are they? If you
want young, to 2 and 5.
You have young kids. Okay, mine are 36 and 31. They worry about money. They don't really worry about money. Okay, they worry about doing what's passionate for them. I mean, they're both extremely passionate, and I always made them work for whatever they had, no matter what it was. Never gave them anything for nothing. Everything had a price, because I basically explained in life, everything costs something, and that is the beauty of appreciation and of humility. What are your thoughts about allowance, or about, even if you have a lot of money, how should you handle it with your kids?
I mean, I think what you did is perfect, because, you know, knowing it or not, being cognizant or not, what you did was you connected labor to money and labor to choices. You have to work to get money, and then you have to make a choice. What am I going to spend it on? Or what am I going to, how am I going to save it? Am I going to invest it? What am I going to do with it? Making that connection is essential. People get hung up on allowance. You know, how much should I give my kid for an allowance? What should I have my kid do to get that allowance? What do they have to do with that allowance? Can they spend it all? Do they have to save some of it? Do they have to give it to a charity? Those are all important questions. And, you know, my colleague Ron Lieber has written a book called The Opposite of Spoiled. It talks all about this. But from my point of view, before you even get into the nitty-gritty, the micro part of the allowance, you need to talk to your kids about money and what it means. And this is where in the book I say, you know, the average person, the middle-class person, the lower-middle-class person, their kids have a strange advantage, a paradoxical advantage over the child of a wealthy person. And that is, if you are a middle-class person and you are thinking of buying a new car, chances are that car is a need. This is not your second car, your third car, your fourth car. This isn't a luxury. This isn't the newest model of XYZ. This is, we have driven our car for 15 years. It's a good car. It now costs more money to repair it because something's happened than it would to just buy a new car. But that involves choice. And, you know, as you know, you've got two grown kids. I have two young kids. Kids look at everything you're doing. I mean, I've started eating yogurt in the past couple of years. I hate yogurt, but I eat it because I want my daughters to eat yogurt. And they say to me, hey, Dad, why don't you eat yogurt? I'm like, oh, I'll eat some yogurt. I put some blueberries in it, some nuts. It's fine.
Why don't you just throw some foie gras in it?
Some foie gras, that, you know, nothing like, you know, a little pate to begin the morning. But it's having those conversations. And so even if the kids aren't paying attention, they're watching the parents, you know, noodle over these numbers. It's like, okay, can we afford the Toyota Corolla? Can we get a Camry? What can we do? Do we finance it? Do we try to pay cash for it? That is making, that's the sort of deep hard wiring. It's really getting into their brains and seeing what their parents have to do. And whereas, you know, if you're wealthy and a new Range Rover shows up, you know, every 3 years, you're losing that connection as to, you know, how much money had to be earned to buy that Range Rover.
I completely agree with you. I think we have actually the same concept with parenting. I also tell parents it's kind of interesting that when they punish their children, they take things away. You know, when my children did things that were worthy of a response, I made them do more work. So rather than take anything away, it's you're going to, like, there's a verse in the scripture that says, let him who stole steal no more, but let him repay four times what he's stolen. So rather than punish them, they simply do more work. And by doing more work, they have this satisfaction that they've paid it back and they feel so much better about it.
That's great.
And it really worked well.
I'm going to steal that from you since I'm at the beginning of this.
You could steal everything you want because I'm getting a $1,000 bottle of sip of champagne. We have a deal. Tell me about your idea, what your feelings are about those who are underemployed or unemployed. Meaning, what would you tell someone who has very little, is in a low-paying job, how to create wealth?
That's an incredibly difficult question because, as I say, at the end
of the question is easy. The answer is hard.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, incredibly difficult question to answer. I say at the end of my book, I mean, look, there is income inequality. The question is not, does it exist? It's, you know, I wonder in the book, were the sort of 70s and 80s this sort of halcyon period of income equality in America? Now, anybody who lived through that can remember all the other horrible things that were happening in the 70s and early 80s. But, you know, historically, there's been a ton of income inequality in America. You go back to the 20s, 30s, 40s, there's income inequality. You look at other countries.
I think everywhere in the world, except the Northern European countries.
Yeah, we had this moment. Is it going away? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. Is it bad if it goes away? Probably. I mean, if you don't have a lot of money, you're in a low-paying job, that's really tough because you don't have, you know, your choices are very limited. I mean, this is a book geared toward sort of middle-class people and above, and really upper middle class people. Why? Because you have to have a level, an earning potential or a level of wealth in the bank for you to be able to contemplate these bigger questions. Because otherwise you're like, okay, how do I pay my rent? How do I buy clothes for work? How do I, you know, feed and clothe my children? Those are, you know, the sort of essential life questions. And, you know, if you're in your 30s, those are hard to answer. I mean, in the book, I talk about, you know, what separates those who end up being very wealthy from those who don't. And there's a strong component of education, which is great if you have young kids. You can do something about it. But it's not great if you're in your 30s and you have kids yourself and you're trying to get yourself out of this hole. So it's not the best answer, but it's the most honest answer I can give.
Right. The problem, though, with education is that for often what I see now is education is about networking more than it is about, unless you're going for architecture, engineering, medicine, and those become, at this point, middle-class jobs. They don't become jobs that create wealth, per se. They do create purpose, and I guess when you have a sense of identity and purpose, you almost always have wealth. I find that identity and purpose creates wealth, not richness. So having a profession will definitely create a sense of wealth. But what about the idea of, you know, kids going to trade school because, you know, the ADD and they're being great carpenters and great auto mechanics and great motorcycle mechanics, they might be making more or the same, you know, than the doctor or lawyer.
It's a great idea, and it's backed up by research done by James Heckman, who won a Nobel Prize in economics in 2001. And Heckman's in my book, and he talks about education in two ways that I think are essential. The first is, if you're going to spend a lot of money on your kids and getting the best education, the best time to spend that money is between the ages of 3 and 8. You know why? So they get into fancy nursery school on the Upper East Side? Not necessarily. The reason is that those are when the big skills are developed. Perseverance, resiliency, things that we hear talk about all the time that will carry them through their lives and help them succeed. Now, on the other hand, on the other end of this, when people, you know, mess up, he did some groundbreaking research on the GED that he presented to Mike Bloomberg when he was mayor and said, you know, you might think that you want to hire somebody with the GED, but you actually don't. And here's why. The research shows that the person with the GED was just as smart as the high school graduate, but he was a goof-off. He was a show-off. He did something, dropped out, and then he went back, got the GED. Far better, you know, for dropouts, for people who get in the wrong path, to teach them a skill. And he talks all about the value of trade schools. If you get one of those kids in there, you know, late teens, 20s, been drifting, and you teach them to be a plumber, you teach them to be an electrician, you teach them a trade, that is the best thing you can do for them to create a good life. Now, it's not as romantic as sending them to City College and having them study poetry, and they go on to win a Pulitzer Prize in poetry, but the number of people who are going to do that is small. The number of people who can benefit from, who've not had the most traditional education path, the number of people who can benefit from getting into a high-paying trade is tremendous.
Paul, what's the correlation between integrity and truthfulness and wealth or riches?
Jeez, I have no idea. That's a great question. I'm not going to lie. I have no idea.
And first of all, I should have got that Nobel Peace Prize because I thought of that way before that. But I'm going to tell you my thoughts. I'm going to tell you that integrity and truthfulness allows you to not to have cognitive dissonance, not to fight against yourself. So therefore, if you are doing business in a way that's honest and transparent, and you're not tricking your way into wealth like some of the brokerage shops. The boiler broker shops where they get people to invest in stocks and they know nothing about the stocks. I don't think that they have really happy lives. And I do think that they may create wealth, but they will never create wealth. So I do see that there is a very, very high component of integrity and transparency and generosity with wealth. Because people tend to respect it and they want to come to you because they know they're going to get a fair deal.
It's interesting. And hearing your thoughts, it made me think of this fellow in the book, the very first chapter in the book, the introduction, of having this lunch with very, very wealthy people. And he's telling his story and they're playing what I call the humble game. You know, who had a humbler beginning? Who, rose from lower depths to great riches. And this guy tells a story, it wasn't for a lucky break in a cab. My dad was a cab driver. I would never have gone to an Ivy League school. I wouldn't be here today. I just sold my real estate company for $225 million. I give generously to my synagogue, to my alma mater. I've got three kids, blah, blah, blah. I hear this story, wonderful story. Go home at the end of the day, type this guy's name into the Google, and it pops up that he was, at one point, considered one of the worst slumlords in New York. Upper East Side sells his real estate property for over $200 million. You know, when you talk about integrity and truthfulness, I think it's key for people to be true to themselves. And I don't want to sound new agey, but don't lie to yourself. Don't lie to yourself and say, what I'm doing has a greater value than it really does. And here's a guy at the end of his life, or toward the end of his life, who's trying to make restitution. You know, he made a lot of money, depending on your point of view, providing subpar housing to people in need or, kind of crushing the back of the working poor. And, to do that, now he set up a camp. He's trying to give away money.
You know what? I completely agree with you. Being true to yourself is not new agey. It is what I am saying, that all anxiety and fear come from that cognitive dissonance, which means not being true to yourself. And having said that, how many people we know, the Rockefellers, all the titans of industry who gave away the majority of their money before they died, knowing that they made their money by enslaving and underpaying so many different people. Now, does that make up for it? I don't know. I'm not the person to judge. But I do find that is definitely true. I would say that for those who are wealthy rather than rich, that they're going to not make all those people miserable before they decide when they're very old to give away all their money. Right before the dirt nap.
We'll put that on a T-shirt.
So let me ask this question. You've been such a great guest, and I haven't even looked at my notes. You write here that contrary to your belief, a stress test found that money makes you personally very stressed. Why is that?
It was talking about money. And so talking about money.
I got it.
And it was an interesting experiment back to Kansas State. where they sort of hooked me up to all kinds of meters. You know, my heart rate, my skin conducent level, which as you know, that's sweaty palms,
right.
Or not all of this stuff. And they asked me basic questions that a financial advisor would ask of a client or a prospective client. And I tried really hard. I answered them all. I answered them honestly. I thought I got all the answers correct. And at the end, I asked the person who's administering this. I said, how'd I do? Did I get them all right? And she looks at me and says, we didn't care about your answers. I said, really? I was an A student. I want to get it right. I said, how'd I do on the test? And she says, you were probably our worst performer. And I said, what do you mean?
You screwed up, Paul.
No, my stress level went through the roof. My temperature was in the 70s. I had sweaty fingertips. Essentially, that fight or flight response kicked in. And I really thought about this a lot. I'm like, why was it? And here I am in Manhattan, Kansas, and it showed sort of the intrinsic stressfulness of talking about money or at least your financial decisions with a stranger. And I live in Fairfield County, Connecticut. We do fine. In Fairfield County, Connecticut, we're upper middle class. In the rest of the country, we are rich. And so having a conversation with some really nice guy at Kansas State, where everybody drives Chevys and Toyotas, I thought, man, he's going to think I'm a rich jerk, but I'm not, man. If you saw where I lived, I'm right in the middle. It just happens to be, the range is greater. And that was, I think, the root of that stress. And this happens every day when people, go in to talk to their advisors. They don't reveal all that they should to make really good decisions.
What would be your response if you lost all your money? How would that change you?
I don't know if it would, but I'm fortunate in an unfortunate way, and that I started off, in the bottom 25%. My parents were divorced. They fought over money all the time. We lived in a lousy neighborhood. This is, I should be making fun of it. I'm playing the humble game here. But,
Yeah, you're telling the truth.
Yeah, my only friend on the street robbed our house. And so,
in your
sounds
only,
like a Woody
your
Allen.
Your only friend on the street.
Imagine the other guys.
The enemies, right.
And so I've seen what it's like there. And I know what I have now, and I'm very grateful of it. But, short of losing all of our money, which I mean, anything could happen, if we had to, live in a house half the size, if we had to make, more decisions
about business,
I'd be happy. Because, and this, I don't want to sound sappy, but, I love my wife, I love my kids, I love what I do, and I could live with a lot less. But I'm fortunate to have that choice. I mean, there are a lot of people who if they had half of what they have now, they wouldn't be subsisisting. They wouldn't be getting by. So it's a luxury choice in my opinion.
Here's Paul's real secret. I'm going to tell everybody Paul's real secret. Here's a guy who's completely genuine, completely transparent. And he actually chose passion and love and integrity over everything else. And that's why you're successful. And that's why you're wealthy.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's the truth. Thank you. On that note, you are just such a delight. Everyone is going to go out and buy your book because it is not only worth reading, but that there are more fights about money and homes than anything else.
Absolutely.
Than anything else. Not sex, not relatives. It's about money. And it's because at the core, people associate money with survival. They associate it with survival, and they associate it with the number one fear that people have, and that's the fear of embarrassment or being ostracized. When it snows 2 inches, everyone panics. When it snows 4 feet, everyone's calm.
You're right. Okay. I'm not going out and driving today.
Right.
I can stay
it's
home.
It's like we're all in the same boat. So like when I was growing up, I'm older than you, obviously. When I was growing up, you had a pair of jeans, you had a T-shirt. I grew up in an apartment building where literally I slept on the floor. Like, my room was 5 feet wide. So, like, a bed really wouldn't fit, okay, So, but it wasn't much different than most of the kids, who I grew up with.
Yeah.
So I was middle class. My father was a plumber. My mom worked, and we had food and, went to public school and so on and so forth. Yeah. The thing that when you don't compare yourself to others and you have a real sense of identity and purpose, you're right. You could do just about anything. And that's why the beauty of your book is that it teaches a lot of lessons more about life than it does about money, or as much as about money.
Yeah. I mean, and that was my goal. I mean, this isn't a book of tips. This is a book of, you know, how to think, how to take the stories that I tell about other people and relate them to your own life, and hopefully how to think a little bit better, or at least differently about the decisions you're making regarding your wealth and your life.
Paul, you achieved your goal.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
I want to once again thank Paul Sullivan for coming on to our show. Pick up a copy of his book, The Thin Green Line, on Amazon.com. And also check out his website at paulsullivan.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem there is a solution. Please check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com and on our YouTube channel by searching for Errol Gluck. Also, visit my website, glucksolutions.org or .com, to learn more about how life coaching and clinical hypnosis will change your life. You change your thinking, you change your life. Thanks for listening. Till next time.